We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts of bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on NABBAclub.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Christy is so kind to come down from Oakwood, and I see her in the rooms in Gainesville. She got another year under her belt and has learned some lessons that I think she's going to share with us. But last time I heard her share, I just wanted her to keep going. You know, she stopped at her 3 minutes, and I wanted to hear the whole hour. So here she is. Please give Christy a big welcome.
Thank you, Tim. Hello, everybody. I'm Christy, and I'm an alcoholic. Had to have my provisions, my tissues, and my big book. Never leave home without them. I don't know what's going on, but it's like the closer that this day came, the more things started happening. The very last thing is I got coffee on my shorts. And they're white. So, you know. Gotta love the evil side. It keeps coming at me no matter what I do. Tim mentioned from page 29 in the big book, you know, that each individual and their personal stories describes in their own words and their point of view how they've established a relationship with God. And I can't see God. I've never seen God. I've never heard Him actually speak to me. I've never seen, like a lot of people say in the rooms, a burning bush. But I can see the result of the faith in other people's lives. And when I first came into the program, to be honest, that was what got my attention first. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I thought I made a bunch of bad decisions and choices, and I got myself into some trouble, and that was about the end of it. And when I came in and I started hearing a lot of the ladies talking about their lives and the things that they were doing, I started listening a little more. I was not convinced. I came in because my counselor said that I had to. Took me about a month to decide to pick up a white chip, and when I picked up that first white chip, it was because I was going to see if I could just not drink for 30 days. And I went home and told my husband, you know, I'm just going to see if I can not drink for 30 days. And prior to that, during the little month that I was playing around, I went to court, I went to counseling, was told to go to AA once a week. We went on vacation, and I tried to do what the DUI class told me to do, you know, 2 drinks a day, no more than 14 a week. Couldn't do it. We went on vacation, too. I got my DUI July 1st, 2009, and we went on vacation the week of July 25th, and 2 beers on the beach just didn't get it. And I was miserable. My family was miserable. And I didn't see anything else around me but the cooler. And I decided, and my husband was still pretty early. He had no idea. I hid everything from him. He had no idea how long I had been drinking and how much I had been drinking, because it was all hidden very well. I became very crafty. And so on vacation, he's like, well, you're okay. You know, you don't really have a problem, because he thought the same thing I did. You know, I just got in trouble. And I can remember since I was a little child, I've been in this extreme hostile relationship with probably what I would say is the most important part of myself, and that's my feelings. It wasn't just my large feelings that I was at war with. It was a struggle. I tried spiritually, mentally, and physically to do everything that I could possibly do to not feel how I felt. And I, you know, a lot of the main things that I did to escape is, at a very early age, I slept all the time. I'd get home from school and I would sleep until I had to get up. My mom made me eat, then I'd go back to sleep. And when I got out for the work program, I slept even more. And I remember one time my mom took me out before I could drive, and she thought something was wrong with me, and she took me to the doctor. So I was anemic, low blood iron. And I just remember, no, I'm fine. And then it's like boyfriends became an obsession. I had to have a boyfriend. And, you know, I spent 2 years of high school obsessed over one boy. And it's like I was constantly asking him out, trying to get him, you know, to like me and to hang out with me and borrow money from my friend Nancy to buy him a watch. Do y'all remember swatches? Those were like the bomb in high school. And it was his birthday, and I wanted him to like me, so she loaned me $30, and I got him a swatch. Don't know how many dinners I bought the fella, but it didn't matter. Shopping. I got a job. Shopping became an obsession. Started working full-time after school. I actually had a couple of jobs after school, and, you know, that became crazy. And my family, I didn't get married until I was 30, so most of all of this, when I say my family, are my parents and my siblings and my nieces and my nephews. But that became one of them. And then when I did get married, you know, having my own children became an obsession. They're going to fix me. Everything that I got obsessed over was supposed to fix me. It's supposed to make me feel better. I'm supposed to get out of myself and be happy. You know, that constant goal for happiness. And over time, you know, alcohol started out fairly early, but it wasn't a big thing. It was definitely a progression for me. And I would say the last year of my drinking, I went way overboard, and it kicked my ass, completely kicked my ass. So with that said, I will start into a little history of my experience in my life. And, you know, I started out, I was born May 19th, 1971, and both of my parents were teenagers when I was born, and both of my parents had alcoholic fathers that were physically abusive. My mother ran down here with my grandmother when she was in elementary school to get away from my alcoholic grandfather. And she became sort of rebellious, I guess, in her teen years, and she got pregnant herself at 15 and was sent away to an unwed mother's home. Because in the 60s, teenagers didn't get pregnant, and it was hidden. So to this day, no one in my mother's family knows that I have a half-sister out there. And, you know, just to give you a little explanation of my mother. So she's very sick to this day because she didn't address that. And my father, he had a third-grade education. He was illiterate. My mother did everything for him. He went to work in warehouses and worked multiple jobs, and he didn't even get a driver's license until way later. So my mother took him to work and back. And so just a little bit of an idea of what my parents were like. And there was a lot of instability in the household because my mother was in charge, and she was somewhat deathly with her charge. She attacked a lot. But anyway, as a child, I was kind of quiet and internal, didn't say a whole lot. I was told at one point to break down my history in tens. So from like 0 to 10, not a lot of activity. I can remember my parents separating and my mother putting everything my dad owns in the back of his truck. I can remember her pulling ahead. I was the oldest of four, and my middle sister is 2 years younger, and then my baby sister is 4 years younger. And she was just a little toddler. I don't even think she could walk yet. And my mother was very physical with things, and she yanked up my sister one day that was the baby, and her arm came out of socket. And I just remember my mother being very dominant and very vocal. At this point, though, I was in Brownies and Girl Scouts, and, you know, did all the kind of normal things that kids did. She started putting us on, me and my one sister, middle sister, on the church bus. So I would say this was my first experience at going to church and hearing about God and what He's like. And I can remember going into the preacher's office and sitting in the chair at one point, because we went for a couple of years, and I did the whole prayer where you invite Jesus in your heart and you want to start living the way that He wants you to live. And That was about the end of that. You know, we went for a little bit longer, and then it wasn't fun anymore. And I can say at this point that there was something in me. I like to take things. I didn't do it a lot, but there is something in me. And as I tell my story, you'll understand what I'm saying. When I say taking things, stealing things, you know, candy from the store. A lot of kids do that. So that's not really abnormal. So at this point, I'm not really abnormal. I'm sort of normal. I have a kind of a fighting instinct. I can remember fighting on the playground in line because I have this bad thing where I think I'm right and I'll fight you to death because I think I'm right. Well, that started in elementary school. So the God seed's planted, my fighting is there, my stealing is there at a very young age. Then we get 11 through 20. My mom gets a little worse. She starts hitting my sister with an ice poker, and she starts fighting with my dad and breaking through the front door, the glass screen door, with a hammer. And you know, it's just a lot more violence started to come, and I got a little more internal and kind of extroverted. I didn't have a lot of friends. I didn't go anywhere, and I certainly didn't want anybody to come to my house. So at this point, a deeper fear of my mom. And I can remember in middle school, I stole a girl's purse and went through all of her stuff. I got paddled. And I don't think they do that anymore. But that thing was about this big and it had holes all in it. And I had to bend over the desk in the principal's office to get paddled. That was horrid. Sixth grade. Stole my aunt's ring from North Carolina, brought it back home and was wearing it. And my mother saw it. I mean, really. Not sure why I thought I was going to get away with it if I was wearing it. I still had that strong need to be wanted and liked. Friends, the boyfriend thing. I made it through high school, but barely. When I was 15, I was kicked out, and I had to live with my granny, and then I lived with my aunt, and then I lived with my granny again, and then I lived with my boyfriend and his mother, and then I lived with another friend and her mother, and got tossed around a good bit and never really got planted. And still, I think that's where the unwanted feeling began to get so strong. And I didn't have anywhere that I belonged. So I really, that was my goal. My goal was to graduate high school and to do whatever I had to take care of myself. Because nobody else was going to take care of me. And I did that. But going back to 15, first party with my friend Nancy. Jack and Coke. Vomited everywhere. She put me in the bathtub. I don't even remember any of it, really. Side of the road, bathtub, bedroom. I mean, just crazy. And so when I think about being an alcoholic and having that allergy that a lot of people talk about, my body, I feel like today, was instantly saying, no, this does not go here. And I didn't really drink a whole lot the rest of high school. A little bit here and there. Started smoking pot and, you know, regular stuff. Most teenagers do, I suppose. Never got really crazy. In 1989, I graduated. Had three jobs. My own apartment. My own car. And no life. Got really tired of that really quick. Ran up a whole lot of credit cards, filed bankruptcy on all of those credit cards because I still wanted what I wanted, but I didn't want to pay for it. It was a really, really, really bad time. Then we get into the early 90s, and I found God again. He came back into my life. I started hanging out with this girl that I had met, and we started going to Mount Perrin North on Tuesday nights, and they rocked. They had a band. They had a preacher that came in, flew in from Alabama, and you know, just really got into God and the Bible and having Bible studies and drinking coffee and eating dessert. It's kind of funny because I thought it was lame then, and now that's all I do now is have coffee and eat dessert. But I got baptized in January of 1992, and by February, I was partying and drinking and totally not thinking about God. I had met a guy in the fall of 91 in North Carolina, and he was in the military, and he wanted to marry me right away, so he gave me an engagement ring that I gladly accepted. And when I was drinking, well, he was going to get me away from here. You know, he was going to get me away from my life and where I lived and everybody was around. And he wanted me. You know, didn't have a lot of that. But at this partying with my friend Kim, and her brother had an apartment. You know, we're still fairly young at this point. I wasn't quite 21 yet, but I was 20. And I came across a guy that I knew from 15, and we started making out in the kitchen, and then we made out in the patio, and the next thing you know, March comes, and I'm mailing the engagement ring back to the dude in the military saying, sorry, I can't marry you. It's just sporadic. My whole life is like that, just from one thing to another, and whatever I'm doing at the time is like my whole focus, 100 miles an hour. So, 21 years old, May 19th, 1992, Buckhead. When Buckhead was right, every weekend. It's not right no more. It's not the same. You know, I walked those streets half-naked, drunker than hell, and nothing ever happened to me. Can't do that today. Lots and lots of fun. Lots of fun. But very shortly after that, I was started dating that guy that I was making out with in the kitchen and the patio, and he was still partying. He was really into a lot of things, a lot of drugs, and didn't want a girlfriend, you know. So I ended up hanging out at his place, waiting for him to come home, and, you know, just kind of being the backup girl, waiting on him. It's kind of sad now that I think about it. He lived at his mother's in the basement. I don't know if any of y'all have ever rolled under a garage door that's about this wide. It's small, but I'm not that small. I barely did. I think I scraped a couple of layers of skin off, but I was determined. I was going to get in there. I was going to be with him. I wrote about that today. You know, but these are the things that haunted me, that made me feel like shit. You know, I did things that no one would really do, you know, for acceptance. You know, and I'm just highlighting some stuff here for you guys to give you an idea of how I lived. But this guy didn't want me either, I didn't think. You know, he wanted to party with his friends, and here I am just giving myself away, and he doesn't care. And I just decided that life was too hard. And in July of 92, I decided to take my life, and I tried really, really hard. Took a lot of pills and drank a lot of beer. Talked to myself for hours and hours and hours. And my parents were out of town with my little sister and little brother. And they left me and my middle sister home. And my sister came home to change clothes to go out with her boyfriend. And she found me. And she ended up calling that guy Mike. And the two of them took me off to the hospital to get my stomach pumped. I don't know if any of y'all have ever had that done. It's disgusting. Even when you're passed out, you still know it's disgusting. I think I had that shit in my teeth for weeks. Oh, it was terrible. But that guy started hanging around and stuff. I thought he was gone for sure after that. But he hung around. We ended up moving in together, and I ended up getting pregnant with him, but he told me he didn't want to have anything to do with me if I had it. He wasn't ready. So, for weeks, he would set the alarm and I would have set it. He would set the alarm and I would have set it. And we would oversleep every weekend for the appointment. And then finally one day he was just aggravated enough and I couldn't unset it. And so I went. And I did something that I didn't want to do so that somebody would love me. And it haunted me for a very long time. But today I can say I'm free of that. But to continue, I started working in Buckhead. My cousin got me a job as a receptionist at a brokerage firm, and I got to move my way up to being a sales assistant, and then to being a manager, and then to being a personal executive assistant to the president and owner. I was the shit. He couldn't do anything without me. I was a very important person. Plus, I got to drive his Porsche all over Atlanta. How cool is that? In your mid-20s? I mean, so I became very important. I got to do lots of things that made me feel really good about myself, and I was needed and wanted by somebody. Well, I started liking this somebody, and he got divorced, and we had fun, and then he really didn't want to have anything to do with me either. He started dating the receptionist that took my place when I moved to the back, and I decided I deserved something. He owed me. I had access to his checking account. It was probably a little over $10,000. Because I would write myself the $1,000 check here, $1,000 check there. Well, I got to where he actually wanted... that guy that took me to the hospital, stayed with me for a little while, he comes in and out of this story a whole lot. I got back with him after it didn't work out with Joe, and we moved in together, and we got engaged. Well, as soon as we got engaged, Joe didn't like that. This is the boss that I took all the money from, but he didn't know I took money yet. So he's going out of town. He hands me his keys to his penthouse, the keys to his Explorer, and he wanted me to move in that weekend while he was gone. Well, I knew what I did. He didn't know what I did, and I was like, mm-mm. So I put everything in, I put his keys in his desk, and I walked out and never went back. Of course, eventually he found out. Had a big IRS bill. He was very kind. Didn't put me in jail. Just made me sign a legal document, and he wrote it off. You know, he wrote off of his taxes, and I paid the IRS. But, you know, God is amazing. Even though I do stupid shit like that, and I deserve to be in jail. He brought a lady into my life that did taxes, that used to be an IRS auditor, that said I was self-employed, and she came up with all kinds of things that, you know, he can use to write off. So I ended up not having to owe the IRS. To me, it's a God thing. I would still be paying it off today if it wasn't. So now we're getting into 31 through 40. You know, I'm still financially irresponsible. I still can't get the money thing right. I've been in and out of things, and I married that guy that took me to the hospital when I was 30, and we moved to Gainesville from Alpharetta. His grandparents have a place that we inherited. We started wanting to have a family, and I couldn't get pregnant. We tried for a couple of years and found out I had endometriosis, and I had a laparoscopy. They lasered, and they're like, oh, you're going to be so fertile. Wasn't. And I went through this period of time where I blamed myself for the previous activities and procedures that I had done to myself. And I thought God was punishing me because of the way that I lived. Come to find out, I just wasn't ovulating and I needed a pill. Who would have thought? A pill. So I did. I took a pill. I got pregnant the first month and had my first child in February of 04. Crazy year. Had my daughter in February. My dad died in April. My pawpaw died in June. My husband bought a restaurant in July. And then my mentor that I had been meeting with once a week for a year and a half died. And then the cat that I had, my Harry. He was with me through everything. When I was in and out of places to live, when I mean, that cat meant more to me than anything, and that was the last straw that year. I mean, it was like a wonderful year because my daughter was born, and I honestly believe today that she is a miracle of God, that it was another blessing that He gave me, because I wouldn't have made it through the rest of the year without her. I held her and looked at her, and I focused on her, and I got through some of the ugliest time of my life. Oh, that restaurant thing. Sounds great, doesn't it? Business owner? Self-employed? Millionaire? Oh, God, no. I didn't have anything to do with the restaurant for a little bit because I was working at, I ended up getting a job at autotrader.com. And I worked there for about 4.5 years before my daughter was born. Well, actually, I was there in the middle of my daughter being born, a couple of years before and a couple of years after. And I didn't have anything to do with the restaurant. It was just my husband's thing, and I let him do it. But I had to sign my life away for it. He couldn't get a loan at the bank without my name. We had to use all the equity in our home to do that. But that was okay. It was his thing. And at the time, I thought it was building something great for our family. My second daughter came really fast because I thought I was going to have to take another pill to get a baby. And that didn't happen. So when my first daughter was one, I was pregnant with the second one. And I was excited. Husband not so excited. I took it very personally that he wasn't excited. And my whole pregnancy with her was a different tone. In the hospital with her was a totally different tone. Coming home with her, totally, he wasn't there. He was all in the restaurant. And I just thought he was using that for an excuse. So I bitched and complained and told him everything he was doing wrong and how he didn't want her. And then I concocted in my mind that he was having an affair with a server. That was hell for several months. And I just couldn't stop with it. And I couldn't stop with about Michaela. January of 06, I started working at the restaurant, and the manager up there, Kathy, did not want me there. It was hard. She was supposed to train me. The first day I go in, she's not there. She's sick. And then when she comes back, her foot's hurt. She can't move. She can't walk. So she just sends me out to the floor to do whatever you do on the floor in front of a restaurant. And I got really pissed off because I thought she was doing that. See, everything was done to me on purpose. Everybody's out to get me. And I took it personally. And after that, it was like I got into the restaurant. I started seeing numbers because I like my spreadsheets. I like to see all the receipts. And I like to put everything in order and what's going out, what's coming in. And it wasn't adding up. And I started telling my husband. And, of course, he immediately put his hand up. None of your concern. So I went into this huge battle with him for about 3 years. It is my business. And you need to do this, and you need to do this, because I was very controlling, and I knew. I know what all y'all need to do. I can fix you. I just can't fix myself, but I can fix you. And I was determined to fix him and make everything the way that I wanted it to be, and it wasn't happening. Everything was falling apart. My marriage was falling apart. Our finances were falling apart. My mother-in-law was about, well, she drove me way past crazy. I started doing some Bible studies at this church to try and help me and change my life. I got fired from Auto Trader for the same problem that I had when I was a little girl. I keep wanting to take things that don't belong to me. Everybody in my department got a quarterly bonus but me. I work hard. I deserve a bonus. Well, my boss was out of town, and I got to do the spreadsheet, and I got to submit it to HR, and so I put me on it. Why not? They didn't catch me the first time. See, this is where I always get myself in trouble. Because if I get away with it once, I end up doing it again. So I did it again. But I wasn't supposed to. He didn't ask me to. I took it upon myself to do it and tell him, oh, I already did it for you. I don't worry about it. I got called in and told to go home. 2 hours after I got home, I was told not to come back. But you know, another God thing kind of happened at that point. They're really unorganized over there, and HR never answers the phone, so I got to get unemployment. I was happy about that. Just meant I had a little cushion to try to work things out. December 31st of 2008, we closed the restaurant, and I was drinking every day at this point. We worked in the restaurant, and we had it at home. I didn't get along with anybody anywhere. I was constantly fighting and fussing and bitching. And, you know, I started out as a timid little person, but a year and a half in the restaurant business as a manager trying to help her husband, owner, who won't do anything she tells him to do, I became a raving bitch. And I screamed and hollered and cussed and fussed at everybody for every little bitty thing. I got my DUI July 1st, 2009, and this was a doozy. I had been drinking all day. My kids were gone. My husband was gone. I went to the pool for a few hours, had some drinks, went home, had some drinks, decided to go out on the boat by myself and park and have some drinks and float. And then I went back home, had some drinks, got ready, decided I wanted to have some shrimp fajitas. So I drove up to Pueblo's and had my shrimp fajitas and some more beers. And my husband calls me in the middle of my dinner, and he's coming home early. Oh, shit. I got to get home. So I'm rushing home. I lost control of my car. Didn't roll it, but almost, I would have rolled it if the tree wasn't there. I wasn't wearing my seatbelt, so I came out of my sunroof and landed on the ground. I can remember a lady talking over me, but I couldn't see anything. It was like having your hands over your eyes. And I could hear, and there was a little blur. And I remember looking back and seeing my purse and my battery charger and all of the things in my trunk were all over the place. And I tried to get up. I said, I got to go. And the lady was like, no, you can't go. Lay back down. I said, no, you don't understand. I got to go. She wouldn't let me leave. And I knew what was coming. And they came, they took me into the hospital. I had 3 broken vertebrae and a broken collarbone. Dirt covered, my whole head and my underclothes, everything was just dirt. I took all the skin off of my shoulder. I remember arguing with the doctor. This had to be the best ER doctor in the whole world. Because he said I wasn't wearing my seatbelt, and I said, yes, I was! You're crazy! If I wouldn't have had my seatbelt on, I wouldn't be hurting over here! So we argued back and forth. He got very aggravated and walked away. But as my sister came and my husband came, I started to kind of sober up a little bit, and I apologized to the doctor, and he ended up being a saving grace, because he called the state trooper first the state trooper was waiting, and they told him he could go and they would call him. Well, the doctor called him and said, hey, is there any way that you could just put a warrant out for her and let her recuperate from her injuries, and then she can just turn herself in? Because my rec was on a Wednesday and I turned myself in on a Monday, and those days at home, I wanted to die. I did not want to wake up from that car wreck. I didn't really want to live at a young age. And at this point, everything in my life that was of value was falling apart. I was drinking all the time. I'm hitting my kids, screaming at my kids, pawning my kids off to my mother-in-law every other day. They were too much to handle. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do anything. I didn't want to get up. And I asked God, why? Why can't I die? Why do I have to keep doing this? Today I know why. I have been very blessed to be able to make it through the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I picked up that white chip. I met some ladies. Started going to a ladies' meeting. I got to do a back-to-basics study right off the bat. I did the steps right off the bat. I told my first story when I was 4 months sober. I was able to get through the fourth and fifth step just shortly after that. I went to a lot of meetings. After my second daughter, I didn't have a job, and so I went to a lot of meetings all day long. I started out in the 6 a.m. meeting because I didn't want to see anybody I knew, and I knew everybody I knew would not be up at 6 a.m. I have some pages in the big book that I had to read, though, when I came in here. Triple X, doctor's opinion. He plans various ways of drinking, changes his brand or his environment. There is this type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink. That was me. I tried all of that. Page 8. No words can tell of the loneliness and the despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. I couldn't think of anything else. From the time I woke up, how much I had, where I was going to get it, started going to different stores because I didn't want the salesperson to think I was an alcoholic. We had dumpsters up front. I have a golf cart. We live in a little golf cart area. I'd pack up all my 12 and 18 pack boxes on the golf cart and take them to the dumpster. We had a refrigerator downstairs and upstairs, and so nothing ever changed. It always looked like it looked before my husband left. And he never saw the trash. Page 23. Therefore, the main problem of alcoholic centers in his mind. I struggled with my head. I struggled with my feelings. I struggled with all the decisions that I ever made. And I was a piece of shit. I was worthless. I was nothing. But I came in here and I was told different. There was a guy that came to the Hawk Club one noon meeting, and I don't think he's ever been back, and this was probably about 2.5 years ago. He was having trouble with his boss and somebody he was working with, and he said he talked to his sponsor about it, and his sponsor said, if you can't change it and you can't remove it, you got to accept it. I don't know why, but that registered with me. And I can say that, you know, I had a year and a half of sobriety and a relapse. So May 10th of 2011 was my second white chip. From May 10th to today, I wake up and I say, God, please keep me sober. Help me not think about drinking today. And he has. And I use that simple little formula. If I can't remove it and I can't change it, then I have to accept it. And there's nothing that I can do about it. And I did this time. I gave my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. And so far, in doing that, my marriage is better. He's my best friend. I've had a rough week of things. My little brother is hooked on crystal meth and he has 4 little kids, and I want to fix it. And in me trying to fix it, I aggravated my husband. I wrecked my car. I spilt my Sprite all over my phone and killed it. All of this has just been in a few days. I can't change it and I can't remove it, so I have to accept it. And I have to accept the fact that I am in my God's hands. And He loves me, and I know He does, because there's too many things that have happened in my life since I have been sober. I set a foundation for myself a year ago. I made a list of the things that are important to me. I put God first and recovery second, because I can't have recovery without Him. And then my family, my husband and my 2 girls. And then my job. Because the job that I have today, it doesn't support our family, but it gives us a little bit of money to go to the movies. You know, I got to buy my girl a scooter. She loves her scooter. Those things make me happy, and that's where I have to focus. And I'm saying this right now because I was off track before I got here. I got lost trying to find it. I could not live down here. I felt like I was going in circles. It's like I'm on the south access, then on the north access, and then I'm on Briarcliff, and then I'm over here. It's like, holy cow! I heard something recently, too. It says that, you know, most people think that we have to work, and then we rest. That was me. I was constantly having to do something all the time. But I heard that you have to rest to work. If you're not rested and your head's not well, you're not going to work well. So I turned my stuff around. I turned my thinking around. Trying to take a little bit better care of myself. I have found that we are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. For sure. I was so nervous coming up here. I looked in this room and I thought, holy crap, it's like a school room. I feel like a teacher. You know, I very quickly found AA to be related to the church that I go to. I got mad at my church. Actually, I got mad at the people at my church. They don't really care. I got in a car wreck. Where was everybody? You know, I go back to church, and if a couple of people that knew what had happened didn't even look at me anymore. I didn't go back for a really long time. And when I finally did, I didn't care about those people. I had new people. I had my AA people. And they loved me no matter what I did, no matter what I shared. Because, boy, did I go to meetings ranting and raving and crying and snotting all over the place. But, you know, I heard a verse earlier when I was still before AA. And, you know, I kept hearing things. You know, offer your bodies as a sacrifice. Don't conform any longer to the ways of this world. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I kept hearing stuff. I wanted to. I wanted to be that way. I wanted to be like some of the people that I saw at church. But I couldn't do it. And today, AA has gotten me in touch with a God that has helped me do so many things, like stand here in front of you and share my story. Saved my marriage. Today, I share a lot at home about my girls. They would flinch, literally, my 8-year-old, because she never knew what I was going to do. And today, there's none of that, and she fights to sit next to me when we go somewhere. She chose to sit next to me instead of her Mimi when we went on vacation. What the heck? I'm special. Last thing, I kind of set a mission statement for myself, for my life. And it's based on the Serenity Prayer. You know, I started out with people saying, you know, whenever you can't go to sleep or whenever you're upset, say the Serenity Prayer. You know, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, wisdom and others. I can't tell you how many times I've said that, a million probably, in the last 3 years. You know, but I have found a new part of that. There's an extended version. I'm not sure if you're aware of Reinhold Niebuhr. I think that's how you say his name. But today, living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace, taking, as Jesus did, the sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that you will make all things right if I surrender to your will, so that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with you forever in the next. Thank you for letting me share my story.
Christy, thank you for speaking the language of the heart, as you always do. Special person. You're one of us, that's for sure.
First I slipped, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are in. And I always long for something that sets me free. Take me where the promise is.